from within. The tiny group of officers in MI6 indoctrinated into the secret were told only what they needed to know. Inside PET, even fewer were aware of Gordievsky's existence. The information he supplied was passed on sparingly to allies, sometimes using intermediaries, or cutouts, in nuggets carefully masked to appear as if they had come from elsewhere. Gordievsky was revealing secrets hand over fist, but MI6 ensured his fingerprints were nowhere upon them. The CIA was not informed about Sunbeam. The so-called special relationship was particularly warm in the intelligence sphere, yet the need-to-know principle applied in both directions. The CIA, it was agreed, certainly did not need to know that Britain had a major spy deep within the KGB. Intelligence services do not like their officers to remain in one place indefinitely, lest they become too comfortable. In the same way, agent runners are rotated to ensure that they do not lose objectivity or end up too heavily invested in one case or a single spy. In accordance with this principle, the KGB resident in Copenhagen, Mogilevchik, was duly replaced by Gordievsky's old friend Mikhail Lyubimov, the amiable Anglophile with the taste for Scotch and tweed tailoring. The two men immediately resumed their friendship. Lyubimov was on his second marriage. The breakup of his first had caused a hiccup in his KGB career, but he was now on the ascendant again. Gordievsky admired this genial, relaxed fellow with his worldly, wry take on the world. They spent long evenings together, chatting and drinking, discussing literature, art, music, and espionage. Lyubimov could see that his friend and protégé would go far. The bosses considered Gordievsky competent and erudite, and he was good at his job. "Oleg behaved impeccably," wrote Lyubimov. "He didn't get involved in any of the infighting, was always ready to provide whatever I wanted, was modest like a true communist, didn't strive for promotion. Some in the embassy staff didn't like him. Arrogant, they called him, too clever by half. But I didn't see these as vices. Don't most people think they are clever?" Only in retrospect did Lyubimov recall some telltale signs. Gordievsky had largely stopped going to diplomatic parties, and other than Lyubimov, he seldom socialized with other KGB officers. He buried himself in dissident literature. In his flat were books by certain authors banned in our country, which I, as his senior colleague, advised him to keep out of sight. The two couples often had dinner together, when Gordievsky would tell jokes, drink a little too heavily, and make a show of being happily married. A remark by Yelena stuck in Lyubimov's memory. "He's not really an extrovert at all," she said. "Don't imagine he's being sincere with you." Lyubimov knew the marriage was under severe strain and paid no attention to the warning. One evening in January 1977, Gordievsky arrived at the safe flat, as usual, to find Philip Hawkins waiting with a bespectacled younger man, whom he introduced as Nick Venables. Hawkins explained that he would soon take up a new posting abroad, and this man was his replacement. The new case officer was Jeffrey Guscott, the high flyer who, 7 years earlier, had read Kaplan's file and flagged Gordievsky as a potential target. Guscott had been acting as Hawkins's desk officer and was therefore familiar with every aspect of the Gordievsky case. But he was nervous. "I thought I knew enough to handle it, but I was still quite young. MI6 said, 'You'll cope,' but I wasn't so sure." Gordievsky and Guscott took to each other at once. The English officer spoke fluent Russian, and from the start they used the familiar form of address. Both were long-distance runners. But more than that, in contrast to Hawkins, Guscott seemed to value Oleg as an individual, not just as a source of information. Inspiring in every way, always cheerful, always sincerely apologetic about any mistakes he made, Guscott was a kindred spirit who now devoted himself to the case full-time, in deep secrecy. Within MI6, only his secretary and immediate superiors knew what he was doing. The Sunbeam case moved up a gear. MI6 offered to supply a miniature camera. With this, Gordievsky could photograph documents inside the Residentura and then hand over the undeveloped film. Oleg declined. The risk of being caught was too high. One glimpse through a half-open door and everything would be finished. Possession of a British-made mini-camera was about as incriminating as evidence could get. But there was another way to smuggle documents out of the KGB station. Messages and instructions from Moscow arrived in the form of long reels of microfilm, transported via the Soviet diplomatic bag. The resident, or more usually the cipher clerks, then cut the film into strips and distributed these to the relevant sections, or lines. Illegals, N. Political, PR. Counterintelligence, KR. Technical, X. And so on. Each length of film might include a dozen or more letters, memos, or other documents. If Gordievsky could smuggle the microfilm strips out of the embassy during his lunch hour, he could transfer them to Guscott, who could copy them and then hand them back. The entire process would take less than half an hour. Guscott passed a request to the MI6 technical department at Hanslope Park, a country house estate in Buckinghamshire, surrounded by leafy parkland and a security cordon of barbed wire and guard posts. Hanslope was, and is, one of the most secretive and heavily guarded outstations of British intelligence. During the war, the Hanslope boffins produced an astonishing array of technical gadgets for spies, including secure radios, secret ink, and even garlic-flavored chocolate, issued to spies parachuting into occupied France to ensure their breath smelled convincingly French on landing. Had Q, the technical wizard in the James Bond series, actually existed, he would have worked at Hanslope Park. Guscott's request was at once simple and challenging. He needed a small portable device that could copy a strip of microfilm, secretly and swiftly. Sankt Annaplatz is a long tree-lined public square in the center of Copenhagen, not far from the Royal Palace. At lunchtime, particularly in good weather, the place is thronged with people. One spring day in 1977, a well-built man in a business suit entered the telephone kiosk at the end of the park. As he was dialing, a tourist wearing a backpack stopped to ask directions and then walked on. In that moment, Gordievsky slipped a roll of microfilm into Guscott's jacket pocket. Jörn Brunn had ensured there was no pet surveillance. A junior officer from the MI6 station loitered on a nearby bench. Guscott rushed to a nearby pet safe house, locked himself in an upstairs bedroom, and took from his backpack a pair of silk gloves and a small flat box, 6 inches long by 3 inches wide, roughly the size of a pocket diary. He drew the curtains, turned off the light, unwound the microfilm strip, inserted one end into the little box, and pulled it through. It was quite a sweaty palm procedure, fiddling in the dark. I always knew that if I couldn't do the operation in time, I would have to abort, and if I damaged the microfilm, it was a real problem. Exactly 35 minutes after the first brush contact, the two men performed another at the other end of the park, imperceptible to anyone but a highly trained surveillance officer, and the reel was back in Gordievsky's pocket. The flow of documents out of the KGB Residentura and into the hands of MI6 swelled to a torrent. Initially just the PR line instructions from Moscow Center, of which Gordievsky was the recipient, then gradually expanding to include microfilm strips issued to other officers, which they frequently left on desks or in briefcases during the lunch hour. The rewards were great, but so were the risks. With each transfer of stolen material, Gordievsky knew he was taking his life in his hands. Another KGB officer might return unexpectedly from lunch and find his microfilm instructions missing. Or Gordievsky might be spotted filching material not intended for his eyes. If he was found to be in possession of microfilm outside the embassy, he was doomed. Each brush contact, Guscott observed with ringing understatement, was highly charged. Gordievsky was terrified, but determined. Each contact left him fizzing with the gambler's rush of a successful gambit, but wondering whether his luck could hold. Even in the coldest weather, he returned to the Residentura in a muck sweat of fear and excitement, hoping his colleagues would not notice his shaking hands. The contact sites followed a deliberately irregular pattern. A park, a hospital, a hotel toilet, a station. Guscott parked a car nearby, in case the copying process had to be carried out inside the vehicle, using a light-proof fabric bag. Despite every precaution, there was no accounting for accidents. On one occasion, Guscott arranged to make a brush contact at a railway station in the north of the city. He placed himself by a window in the station cafe and drank a coffee while waiting for Gordievsky to appear and leave a roll of microfilm under a ledge in the nearby telephone kiosk. The Russian duly appeared, made the drop, and walked away. But before Guscott could get to the kiosk, a man stepped into it ahead of him and began making a telephone call. A long telephone call. The minutes slipped past as the man obliviously chattered on, inserting one coin after another. There was only a 30-minute window in which to pick up the film, copy it, and return it at a second contact site in another location, and it was closing fast. Guscott loitered outside the telephone box, hopping from foot to foot, exhibiting an anxiety that was not feigned. The man on the telephone ignored him. Guscott was on the point of barging in and grabbing the roll when the man finally hung up. Guscott reached the second brush contact site with less than a minute to spare. As Lyubimov's deputy and confidant, Gordievsky had access to many of the microfilms, and the volume of tape blossomed. Scores, and eventually hundreds of documents, were extracted and copied, with details of code names, operations, directives, and even the entire 150-page confidential review compiled by the embassy, a complete picture of Soviet diplomatic strategy in Denmark. The information was carefully parceled out back in London, disguised, and then distributed, piecemeal, to MI5 if it affected national security, and occasionally, if sufficiently important, to the Foreign Office. Of Britain's allies, only the Danes received direct intelligence from the Sunbeam files. Some of the material, notably that relating to Soviet espionage in the Arctic, was shown to the Foreign Secretary, David Owen, and the Prime Minister, James Callaghan. No one was told where it had come from. Guscott flew to Denmark more frequently, and stayed for longer, moving into the Belarus flat for 3 days at a stretch. The two spies would carry out a microfilm exchange at lunchtime on Friday, then meet at the flat on Saturday evening, and again the next morning. His romantic trysts with Leila, and his espionage assignations with Guscott, meant that Gordievsky was away from home for longer and longer periods. He told Yelena he was busy with secret KGB work that was none of her business. She may or may not have believed him. Gordievsky's conditions for cooperation diluted, then evaporated. The Russian knew he was being recorded. He abandoned his own refusal to reveal names and identified every KGB officer, every illegal, and every source. Finally, he agreed to accept money. Guscott told him that, from time to time, sterling would be deposited for him in a London bank as a contingency, a measure of Britain's gratitude, and an unstated acknowledgement that, eventually, he would defect to the UK. Gordievsky might never be able to spend his espionage earnings, but he valued the gesture and accepted the cash. Gordievsky was more valuable than money, and there was another highly symbolic way to show it. A personal thank you letter from the chief of MI6. Morris Oldfield, the most senior spy in Britain, signed himself C in green ink, a practice first adopted by the founder of MI6, Mansfield Cumming, who imported it from the Royal Navy, where ship's captains customarily write in green ink. The tradition has been adopted by every MI6 chief since. Guscott typed a letter of thanks and congratulations from Oldfield to Gordievsky, in English, on thick cream notepaper, which the head of the service signed with a green flourish. Guscott translated it into Russian and presented both the original and the translation to Gordievsky at their next meeting. Oleg's face lit up as he read the encomium. Guscott took the letter away again when they parted. A personal letter, signed in green ink from Britain's spymaster-in-chief, was not the sort of souvenir to keep in his possession. It was a way to reassure Oleg that we took him seriously, and put it on a formal footing, to establish a personal connection, and show Oleg he was dealing with the organization itself. That all helped to settle him down, and marked the maturity of the case. At the next meeting, Gordievsky produced his reply to Oldfield. The correspondence between Sunbeam and C remains in the MI6 archives, proof of the personal touch on which successful spying depends. Gordievsky's letter was his testament. I must emphasize that my decision is not the result of irresponsibility or instability of character on my part. It has been preceded by a long spiritual struggle and by agonizing emotion, and an even deeper disappointment at developments in my own country and my own experiences have brought me to the belief that democracy and the tolerance of humanity that follows it represents the only road for my country, which is European in spite of everything. The present regime is the antithesis of democracy to an extent which Westerners can never fully grasp. If a man realizes this, he must show the courage of his convictions and do something himself to prevent slavery from encroaching further upon the realms of freedom. Gunvor Huyk arranged to meet her KGB controller, Alexander Principalov, on the evening of January 27, 1977. The Russian was waiting when she arrived at the rendezvous, a dark side street in an Oslo suburb. So were three officers of the Norwegian Security Service, who pounced. After a violent struggle, the Soviet officer was finally subdued, and some 2,000 krona was found in his pocket, the latest payment to Greta. Huyk offered no resistance. Initially, she admitted only to her love affair with the Russian Kozlov, but finally she broke down. "I shall now tell it how it is. I have been a Russian spy for nearly 30 years." She was charged with espionage and treason. Huyk died of a sudden heart attack in prison 6 months later, before her case came to trial. In the diplomatic fallout, Gennady Titov, the KGB resident, was expelled from Oslo, and news that an important agent had been arrested in Norway filtered swiftly down to the KGB station in Denmark, prompting a flurry of speculation among the officers and, in the case of one of them, a cold prickle of fear. Gordievsky assumed his tip-off had led directly to her arrest. Everyone connected to the case would now be interviewed. If the talkative Czerny remembered his idle conversation about Greta with Gordievsky from a few months earlier and was brave enough to report it, the KGB mole hunters might start to pick up the trail. The weeks passed without a tap on his shoulder, and Gordievsky slowly relaxed. But the incident was a sobering warning. If the information he passed over was acted on too obviously, it would lead to his destruction. Yelena Gordievsky was nobody's fool. Her husband was up to something. Increasingly, he was away overnight, and for weekends, offering only the most curt explanations for his absences. Yelena knew, without having to be told, that her husband was having an affair. She accused him, angrily. He denied it, unconvincingly. A series of unpleasant scenes ensued in the flat, loud and doubtless overheard by their KGB neighbors. This was followed by a furious, wordless silence. The relationship was all but dead, but they were both trapped. Like Gordievsky, Yelena did not want her own KGB career to be damaged by scandal, and she wanted to remain in Denmark. A breakup would see them both on the next plane to Moscow. They had married in obedience to KGB rules, and they must stay married, at least in name, for the same reason. But the marriage went black. One day, Guskott asked Gordievsky if he was under any undue stress. Clearly, the Danish eavesdroppers had overheard the domestic turmoil and flying crockery in his apartment and reported back to MI6. He reassured his case officer that, although his marriage might be coming apart, he was not. But it was another reminder that he was being watched, even by those who were now his friends. Layla was an emotional haven. Compared to the grim compromises in his crumbling marriage, the moments of intimacy with her seemed all the sweeter for being snatched and hurried, seized in one hotel room or another. "We made plans to marry as soon as I could disentangle myself," he wrote. Yelena was all elbows and anger, whereas willowy, dark-haired Layla was soft, kind, funny. She had been born and bred into the KGB. Her father, Ali, had been recruited in his early 20s in his hometown of Sheki in northwest Azerbaijan. Her mother, one of seven children of a poor Moscow family, was also KGB, and had met her future husband on a training course in Moscow soon after the war. But, unlike his wife, Gordievsky never felt she was watching him, assessing him. Her very naivety was an antidote to the complexity of his life. He loved her as he had never loved anyone before. But he was simultaneously engaged in a tumultuous secret affair with MI6. His emotional desires and his espionage stood in direct conflict. Divorce and remarriage would damage not only his KGB career, but also his prospects of obtaining more valuable intelligence for MI6. Love often begins with an outpouring of naked truth, a passionate baring of the soul. Layla was young and trusting, and she believed utterly in her handsome, considerate lover. "I never felt I stole him from Yelena. Their marriage was finished. I idolized him. I put him on a pedestal. He was perfect." But unbeknownst to her, he was never fully present. Half my existence and my thoughts had to remain secret. He wondered if his double life would make an authentic marriage of minds impossible. Could I establish the close, warm relationship I longed for? He finally confided to Mikhail Lyubimov that he was having an affair with a young secretary at the World Health Organization and hoped to marry her. His friend and boss was sympathetic, but realistic. From personal experience, Lyubimov knew that his protege's prospects would suffer when the KGB Puritans discovered the situation. After his own marriage failed, Lyubimov had been demoted and ignored for several years. "A divorced Oleg was doomed to get a dull backroom job," he wrote. The resident promised to put in a good word with the bosses. Gordievsky and Lyubimov had grown even closer. In the summer of 1977, they traveled together to the Danish coast for a weekend break. On the beach one afternoon, Lyubimov described how, as a young KGB officer in 1960s London, he had cultivated various figures on the left, including a fiery Labour MP named Michael Foote, who was seen by Moscow as a potential agent of influence, someone who could be fed pro-Soviet ideas and reproduce them in articles and speeches. The name meant nothing to Gordievsky. Lyubimov might be a friend for life, but he was also a prime source of intelligence. Everything Gordievsky gleaned from him was passed back to MI6, including documents personally addressed to the resident under his codename, Corin. The friendship was also a betrayal. Lyubimov later reflected, "Oleg Gordievsky was playing me like a penny whistle." After each meeting, Guscott reported personally to Oldfield. During one of these debriefing sessions, the case officer described how Lyubimov was being chatted up by the new head of station in Copenhagen and seemed very friendly. "Sunbeam will eventually leave Denmark, so we should be looking for a replacement target. Who better than Lyubimov? He is very Anglophile and has been tapped up once already. You would like him. He's also a raging snob, and he might respond well to an approach by someone senior." Thus was born a radical idea. Maurice Oldfield, the chief of MI6, would fly to Copenhagen and try to recruit the KGB resident in person. The director of counterintelligence was having none of it. C could not be risked on an active operation, and if it went wrong, then attention would be drawn to Gordievsky. "The plan was kiboshed, thank God," said one intelligence officer. "It was insane." Gordievsky wrote, "I felt relief and euphoria that I was no longer a dishonest man working for a totalitarian regime. Yet dishonesty demanded emotional deception, fraud in a virtuous cause, a sacred duplicity. He was telling MI6 every secret truth he could find, while lying to his colleagues and his bosses, his family, his best friend, his estranged wife, and his new lover." Chapter 5. A Plastic Bag and a Mars Bar. On Westminster Bridge Road in Lambeth, not far from Waterloo Station, stood Century House, a large, ugly 22-story office block of glass and concrete. The building was wholly unremarkable. The men and women who passed in and out looked like all the other office workers in the area. But an inquisitive observer might have noticed that the security guard in the lobby was more muscular and a good deal more alert than the regulation issue. He might also have wondered why so many telephone engineering vans were parked outside the office at odd times of day. He might have spotted that the workers kept irregular hours, and noticed the chunky electric bollards guarding the underground parking garage. But had the inquisitive observer hung around long enough to notice these things, he would have been arrested. Century House was the headquarters of MI6, and the most secret premises in London. Officially, it did not exist, and nor did MI6. It was a place so discreet and deliberately commonplace that new arrivals often wondered if they had mistakenly been sent to the wrong address. There were even those who were recruited into the service, wrote one former officer, but did not realize until after they had completed a week or two's work there. The public remained perfectly ignorant of the real purpose of this undistinguished building, and those few officials and journalists who did know what it was for kept mum. The Sov block controllerate took up the whole of the 12th floor. In one corner stood a cluster of desks occupied by the P5 section, the team running Soviet operations and agents, which liaised with the Moscow MI6 station. Only three people in P5 knew of the Gordievsky case. One of them was Veronica Price. Price was 48 in 1978, unmarried, dedicated to the service, and one of those brisk, practical, quintessentially English women who brooks no nonsense, least of all from men. The daughter of a solicitor who had been badly wounded in the First World War, bits of shrapnel fell out of him for the rest of his life. She grew up with a strong sense of patriotic rectitude, but also a streak of drama inherited from her mother, a former actress. "I didn't want to be a lawyer. I wanted to travel." Having failed to get into the Foreign Office due to inadequate shorthand, she wound up as a secretary in MI6. She served in Poland, Jordan, Iraq, and Mexico. But it took MI6 nearly 20 years to realize that Veronica Price's skills went far beyond typing and filing. In 1972, she took an exam to become one of the first women officers in the British Secret Service. 5 years later, she was appointed deputy to the head of P5. Every day, she commuted to Century House from the home counties, where she lived with her widowed mother, her sister Jane, several cats, and a large collection of bone china. Price insisted on doing things properly. She was very sensible and, as one colleague put it, completely single-minded. She liked solving problems. In the spring of 1978, Veronica Price was indoctrinated into the Gordievsky case, and so it was that she found herself grappling with a problem that had never faced MI6 before: how to smuggle a spy out of Soviet Russia. A few weeks earlier, Gordievsky had arrived at the safe flat, looking tired and preoccupied. "Nick, I need to think about my security. For the first 3 years I didn't think about it, but soon I will be returning to Moscow. Can you organize an escape from the Soviet Union for me, in case I come under suspicion? If I go back, is there some way I can get out?" Disquieting rumors had begun to circulate. Moscow Center suspected a spy was operating within the KGB. The gossip did not suggest the leakage was coming from Denmark, or even Scandinavia, but the mere hint of an internal investigation was enough to provoke a nasty shiver of apprehension. What if MI6 had itself been penetrated? Was another Philby lurking inside British intelligence, ready to expose Gordievsky? There was no guarantee he would eventually get another foreign posting, particularly if he divorced, and he might find himself trapped in the Soviet Union forever. Gordievsky wanted to know that there was a chance he could get out if he needed to. Spiriting the Russian spy out of Denmark would have been child's play, requiring only a call to his emergency number, a night in a safe house, a false passport, and a ticket to London. But engineering an escape from Moscow, if the KGB uncovered him, was a very different prospect, and probably impossible. Guscott's response was sobering. "We cannot make any promises, and we cannot give 100% guarantee that you can escape." Gordievsky knew the probability of success was much lower than that. "Of course," he replied, "that is absolutely clear. Just give me the possibility, just in case." The Soviet Union was, in effect, an enormous prison, incarcerating more than 280 million people behind heavily guarded borders, with over 1 million KGB officers and informants acting as their jailers. The population was under constant surveillance, and no segment of society was more closely watched than the KGB itself. The Seventh Directorate was responsible for internal surveillance, with some 1,500 men deployed in Moscow alone. Under Leonid Brezhnev's inflexible brand of communism, paranoia had increased to near Stalinist levels, creating a spy state, pitting all against all, in which phones were tapped and letters opened, and everyone was encouraged to inform on everyone else, everywhere, all the time. The Soviet invasion of Afghanistan and the resulting spike in international tension had intensified KGB internal scrutiny. Fear by night and a feverish effort by day to pretend enthusiasm for a system of lies was the permanent condition of the Soviet citizen, writes Robert Conquest. Infiltrating, recruiting, and maintaining contact with spies inside the Soviet Union was extremely difficult. The few agents enlisted or inserted behind the Iron Curtain tended to vanish, without warning or explanation. In a society permanently on the alert for espionage, the life expectancy of a secret agent was short. When the KGB net closed, it did so with brutal speed. But, as a serving KGB officer, it seemed possible that Gordievsky might get wind of an imminent threat to his safety, giving him just enough time to attempt an emergency escape. This was exactly the sort of challenge Veronica Price relished, and she was already something of a specialist in the art of exfiltration. In the mid-1970s, she had arranged Operation Invisible, the smuggling of a husband and wife team of Czech scientists across the border into Austria. She had also sprung a Czech intelligence officer, codenamed Disarrange, out of Hungary. But the Czechs and the Hungarians didn't have the KGB, she said. Russia was much, much harder, and the distance to reach safety much farther. Quite apart from losing the agent, a failed escape would hand the Russians a major propaganda weapon. One possibility was by sea. Price began investigating whether, using forged documents, a fugitive might be able to board a commercial liner or merchant vessel sailing from one of the Russian ports. But the docks and harbors were as heavily policed as the frontiers and airports, and producing forgeries was virtually impossible, since official Russian documents included watermarks, like banknotes, that could not be replicated. A motorboat might possibly ferry an escaping spy to safety across the Black Sea to Turkey, or across the Caspian to Iran, but there was a strong chance of being intercepted by Soviet patrol vessels and sunk. The long Turkish and Iranian land borders with the USSR were hundreds of miles from Moscow, and heavily defended by guards, minefields, electric fences, and barbed wire. The diplomatic bag could be used to transport sensitive items across borders, principally documents, but also drugs, weapons, and, conceivably, people. Opening a parcel marked as diplomatic luggage was technically a violation of the Vienna Convention. Libyan terrorists smuggled guns into Britain this way. The Soviets themselves had attempted to expand the definition of a diplomatic bag by claiming that a 9-ton truck filled with crates and destined for Switzerland should be exempt from search. The Swiss refused. In 1984, a fugitive diplomat in London, the brother-in-law of the newly deposed Nigerian president, was drugged, blindfolded, put in a wooden crate labeled extra cargo, and addressed to the Ministry of International Affairs in Lagos. He was discovered by customs officials at Stansted Airport and released. A man-sized diplomatic bag emerging from the British Embassy in Moscow would not pass unnoticed. One by one, each option was rejected as unfeasible or insanely risky. But there was another tradition of international diplomacy that might possibly be manipulated to Gordievsky's advantage. According to long-standing convention, cars driven by embassy staff with diplomatic license plates are not usually subject to search when crossing international frontiers, an extension of diplomatic immunity, whereby diplomats are granted safe passage and protection from prosecution under the laws of the host country. But this was a convention, not a legal rule, and Soviet border guards felt little compunction in searching any car that aroused suspicion. Still, it was a small gap in the fortified wall surrounding Russia. A spy hidden inside a diplomatic car might conceivably slip through this chink in the Iron Curtain. The Russian border with Finland was the nearest east-west frontier to Moscow, though still a 12-hour drive from the Russian capital. Western diplomats regularly visited Finland for rest and recreation, shopping or medical treatment. They usually travelled by car, and the Russian border guards were used to seeing diplomatic vehicles pass through the checkpoints. But getting an escapee into a car posed another conundrum. The British embassy, consulate, and all diplomatic residences were securely guarded by KGB officers in police uniform. Any Russian attempting to enter was stopped, searched, and closely interrogated. Moreover, British embassy cars were routinely tailed by KGB surveillance wherever they went, and diplomatic vehicles were serviced by KGB mechanics who, it was assumed, fitted them with hidden bugs and tracking devices. After weeks of attacking the problem from every angle, Veronica Price framed a plan, peppered with conditionals. If Gordievsky could alert the MI6 station in Moscow that he needed to escape, if he could make his own way to a rendezvous point near the Finnish border without being followed, if a diplomatic car driven by an MI6 officer could throw off KGB surveillance for long enough to pick him up, if he could be hidden securely inside the vehicle, and if the Soviet border guards adhered to diplomatic convention and let them pass through without investigation, then he might escape to Finland, where he could still be arrested and sent back to Russia by the Finnish authorities. It was the longest of long shots, but it was the best shot Veronica Price could come up with, which meant it was the best shot available. The MI6 head of station in Moscow was instructed to find a suitable rendezvous point near the Finnish border where a fugitive might be picked up. He drove to Finland from Leningrad, as if on a shopping trip, and identified a turnout that could serve as the pickup point, about 36 miles short of the border, and close to the road sign marked Kilometer Post 836, indicating the distance from Moscow. Militia posts 10 miles apart, known as GAI posts, an acronym for State Automobile Inspectorate, monitored the movement of all traffic, but especially foreign cars. The turnout was almost equidistant between two of them. If the MI6 pickup car paused for a few minutes, assuming it was not being tailed by the KGB, the next militia post would probably not spot the delay. The area was heavily wooded, and a track arced off to the right in a wide D-shaped loop, shielded from the road by a line of trees, before rejoining the highway. A large rock, the size of a London terraced house, marked the entrance to the turnout. The MI6 officer took some photographs out of the car window and motored on south toward Moscow. Had he been spotted, the KGB would surely have wondered why a British diplomat wanted to photograph a big rock in the middle of nowhere. Veronica Price's plan also required a signal site, where Gordievsky could indicate when he wanted to pass on a message or needed to escape. Many of the British diplomats in Moscow, including the MI6 station of two officers and a secretary, were housed in the same complex on Kutuzovsky Prospect, known as Kutz, a wide avenue to the west of the Moscow River. On the other side of the avenue, in the shadow of the Soviet Gothic Tower, the Hotel Ukraine, was a bread shop, beside a set of billboards displaying bus timetables, concert performances, and copies of Pravda. The place was usually thronged with people reading the newspapers, and the bread shop was much used by foreigners from the well-guarded housing complex opposite. The plan envisaged that at 7:30 p.m. every Tuesday when Gordievsky was in Moscow, a member of the MI6 station would police the signal site. The spot was actually visible from parts of the housing complex. An MI6 officer would head out with the excuse of buying bread, or time his return from work to be passing the site at exactly the right moment. The exfiltration plan could be activated in only one way. Gordievsky must be standing by the bread shop at 7:30, holding a plastic bag from a Safeway supermarket. Safeway bags bore a large red S, an immediately recognizable logo that would stand out in the drab Moscow surroundings. Gordievsky had lived and worked in the West, and there would be nothing particularly remarkable about his holding such an object. Plastic bags were prized, especially foreign ones. As an additional recognition signal, Gordievsky should wear a grey leather cap he had recently purchased and a pair of grey trousers. When the MI6 officer spotted Gordievsky waiting by the bread shop with the all-important Safeway bag, he or she would acknowledge the escape signal by walking past him carrying a green bag from Harrods and eating a chocolate bar, either a Kit Kat or a Mars bar. A literally hand-to-mouth expedient, as one officer remarked. The chocolate eater would also be wearing something grey, trousers, skirt, or a scarf, and would make brief eye contact, but not stop walking. Grey was an unobtrusive colour, and therefore helpful in averting pattern accumulation by watchers, the downside being that it was all but invisible in the murk of a long Moscow winter. The escape signal having been flown, the second stage of the plan would swing into operation. 3 days later, on the Friday afternoon, Gordievsky should catch the overnight train to Leningrad. There was no suggestion that Yelena would be coming too. On arrival in Russia's second city, he would take a taxi to the Finland station where Lenin famously arrived to launch the revolution in 1917 and take the first train to Zelenogorsk, up the coast on the Baltic Sea. From there, he would catch a bus heading for the Finnish border and get off at or near the rendezvous point, about 16 miles south of the border town of Vyborg and 26 miles from the frontier itself. At the turnout, he should hide in the undergrowth and wait. Meanwhile, two MI6 officers driving a diplomatic car would have set off from Moscow and spent the night in Leningrad. The precise timings were dictated and complicated by Soviet bureaucracy. Official permission to travel had to be obtained 2 days before departure, and special export license plates needed to be attached to the diplomatic car. The garage performing this function was only open on Wednesdays and Fridays. If Gordievsky flew the signal on Tuesday, then the car paperwork could be completed by 1 o'clock on Friday afternoon, and the MI6 team could depart later that day so as to arrive at their rendezvous site at exactly 2:30 in the afternoon on Saturday, a gap of just 4 days. They would drive into the turnout as if intending to have a picnic. When the coast was clear, one of the officers would open the hood of his car. That would be Gordievsky's signal to emerge from hiding. He would immediately climb into the trunk of the car, where he would be wrapped in a space blanket to deflect the infrared cameras and heat detectors believed to be deployed at Soviet borders and given a tranquilizer pill. He would then be driven across the border into Finland. The escape plan was codenamed Pimlico. In MI6, as in most secret services, codenames were in theory allocated randomly from an officially approved list. Usually they were real words, and deliberately anodyne in order to give no hint of what they referred to. But spies frequently cannot resist the temptation to choose words that resonate, or offer some subtle or less than subtle clue to reality. The keeper of MI6's code words was a secretary named Ursula, her real name. You rang Ursula and asked her for the next name on the list, but if you didn't like it, you could go back and try to get her to give you a better one. Or you could get a whole set of code words for different aspects of the case, and then choose the one you liked best. The wartime MI5 codename for Stalin, meaning Man of Steel, was Gliptik, meaning an image carved in stone. The Germans codenamed Britain Golfplatz, or golf course. Code words could even be used as a veiled insult. There was some snorting in Century House when a CIA cable accidentally revealed that the American codename for MI6 was Uptight. Pimlico sounded quintessentially British, and Britain was where, if it worked, Gordievsky would end up. At their next meeting, Gordievsky listened politely as Guscott outlined Pimlico. He studied the photographs of the rendezvous spot and attended carefully to the arrangements for the escape signal at Kutuzovsky Prospect. Gordievsky thought long and hard about Veronica Price's escape plan, and then pronounced it completely unworkable. It was a very interesting, imaginative plan for escape, but so complicated. There were so many details, unrealistic conditions for the signal site. I didn't take it seriously. He committed the plan to memory, and inwardly prayed that he would never have to remember it. Back in Century House, Skeptics said Pimlico would never work. I took it very seriously, Price later recalled. A lot of others didn't. In June 1978, Mikhail Yubimov ushered Gordievsky into his office at the Soviet embassy in Copenhagen and told him he would soon be returning to Moscow. The end of his second, 3-year posting in Denmark was no surprise, but it raised a number of issues for his marriage, his career, and his espionage. Yelena, now fully aware of her husband's long affair with the secretary, agreed to a divorce once they were back in Moscow. Layla's job with the World Health Organization was also coming to an end, and she would be returning to Russia as well in a few months. Gordievsky wanted to remarry as soon as possible, but he was under no illusions about the impact a divorce would have on his career. Gordievsky had risen far and fast within the KGB, and at the age of 40, he was now being considered for a major promotion to the post of deputy head of the Third Department, with responsibility for Scandinavia. But he had made rivals and enemies along the way, and the puritanical backbiters at Moscow Center would be itching for an excuse to cut down the tall poppy. "They'll go for you," warned Lyubimov, speaking from personal experience. "Not only will they condemn you for the divorce, they'll also accuse you of having had an affair en poste." The resident sent a report to Moscow, commending Gordievsky as a thorough, politically right-thinking officer, strong in all aspects, a good linguist, and a competent writer of reports. Lyubimov also wrote a cover letter to the department head, describing Gordievsky's marital problems and urging leniency in the hope this might soften the blow. Both men knew that, given the ferocious modelism of Moscow Center, he was probably heading back to a long stint in the doghouse. With his return to Moscow looming, and his professional future uncertain, Gordievsky might have taken this opportunity to end his career as a spy and go to ground. MI6 had always made it clear that he could bail out and take sanctuary in the UK at any point. He might understandably have decided that, rather than return to the grim privations and repression of Soviet life, he would now like to defect to the West and, if possible, take his lover with him. But the possibility of defecting does not seem to have crossed his mind. He would go back to Russia, nurture in secret his newfound allegiance to Britain, gather what secrets he could, and bide his time. "What are your ambitions for your time in Moscow?" Guskot asked him. "I want to find out the most secret, the most important, the essential elements in the Soviet leadership," Gordievsky replied. "I want to find out how the system works. I will not be able to find everything, because the Central Committee keeps secrets even from the KGB. But I will find whatever I can." Here lay the essence of Gordievsky's rebellion, to find out as much as he could about the system he loathed, the better to destroy it. Like long-distance running, successful espionage requires patience, stamina, and timing. Gordievsky's next job was likely to be in the Third Department, covering Britain and Scandinavia. He would study the KGB from within, gathering whatever information might be useful to Britain and the West. Once any fuss about his divorce and remarriage subsided, he would probably resume his upward climb through the KGB ranks, as Lyubimov had done. Perhaps in as little as 3 years, he might land another foreign posting. He would pace himself during the next lap. Whatever might arise in Moscow, his commitment would continue. He would stay in the race. A spy, deep within the KGB, was the ultimate prize of every Western intelligence agency. But as the chief of the CIA, Richard Helms, observed, infiltrating an agent into the KGB was as improbable as placing resident spies on the planet Mars. The West had very few Soviet agents inside the USSR worthy of the name, which meant that reliable intelligence of the enemy's long-range plans and intentions was practically non-existent. British intelligence now had an opportunity to exploit their man inside the KGB to the full by extracting any and every secret he came across. Instead, MI6 decided to do the opposite. In an act of self-discipline and self-denial almost unique in intelligence history, Gordievsky's spymasters did not encourage him to remain in contact in Moscow or try to feed back secrets. Instead, the agent runners of Century House opted to let their spy lie fallow. Once he was back in Moscow, Gordievsky would be left entirely alone. The reasoning was simple and flawless. In Russia, it would be impossible to run Gordievsky as he had been handled in Denmark. There was no safe house in Moscow, no friendly local intelligence service willing to watch his back, no reliable fallback should he be uncovered. The level of surveillance was too intense, with every British diplomat, and not just suspected intelligence officers, under constant watch. The history of running agents in the Soviet Union proved that overeagerness was almost always fatal, as shown by Penkovsky's grim demise. Sooner or later, and usually sooner, the spy was uncovered by the all-seeing state, captured, and liquidated. As one MI6 officer put it, Oleg was too good to jeopardize. We had something so precious that we had to exercise restraint. There was enormous temptation to continue contact in the Soviet Union, but the service lacked confidence that we would be able to do this sufficiently often and securely. There was a good chance that we would burn him up. Guskot informed Gordievsky that MI6 would not seek to communicate with him in Moscow. There would be no attempt to set up clandestine meetings or harvest intelligence. But if Gordievsky needed to make contact, he could. At 11 a.m. on the third Saturday of every month, MI6 would send an officer to loiter under the clock in Moscow's central market just off the Garden Ring Road, a bustling spot where a foreigner would not look out of place. Again, he or she would be carrying the Harrods bag and wearing some grey clothing. The purpose of this was twofold. If Oleg just wanted reassurance that we were continuously looking out for his interests, he could see us but not make himself visible. If he wanted to make a brush contact and pass on a physical message, he would make himself visible by means of the grey cap and Safeway bag. If he appeared with the bag and cap, then the brush contact plan went into a second phase. Three Sundays later, he should go to St. Basil's Cathedral in Red Square and ascend the spiral staircase at the rear of the building at exactly 3 p.m. Again, for ease of recognition, he should wear his grey cap and grey trousers. An MI6 officer, probably a woman wearing a grey item of clothing and holding something grey in both hands, would time her descent from the upper floor, and in the constricted space, passing abreast, he could then pass her a written message. The brush contact should only be initiated if he uncovered information with a direct impact on British national security, such as a Soviet spy inside the UK government. MI6 had no way to respond to such a message. If he needed to escape, he could activate the exfiltration plan by standing at the bread shop on Kutuzovsky Prospect with his Safeway bag at 7:30 on a Tuesday evening. MI6 would monitor the site every week. Having rehearsed the plans, Guskot handed over a hardback copy of the Oxford University Press edition of Shakespeare's sonnets. It looked like an ordinary souvenir that a Russian might take home from the West. In reality, it was an ingenious aide-memoir, a gift from Veronica Price. Beneath the endpaper, the paper covering the inside of the back cover, was a small sheet of cellophane on which Operation Pimlico was written out, in Russian. The details of the timings, recognition clothing, escape signals, the rendezvous point after the 836-kilometer mark, and the distances between key points. Gordievsky should place the book in the bookshelf of his Moscow apartment. To refresh his memory before attempting to escape, he could soak the book in water, peel back the end paper, and extract the plastic sheet. As a further security measure, the place names were changed from Russian to French. Moscow was Paris, Leningrad was Marseille, and so on. If the KGB found the crib while he was still heading for the border, it would not necessarily give away the precise escape route. Guskot finally handed over a London telephone number. If and when Gordievsky found himself outside the Soviet Union and felt it was safe to do so, he should call the number. Someone would always answer. The Russian wrote down the number in his notebook backward, amid a jumble of jottings. Some months earlier, Gordievsky had passed Guskot an important morsel of information, plucked off the Scandinavian grapevine. The KGB, or the military GRU, and possibly both, had recruited an important spy in Sweden. Details were sketchy, but the mole appeared to work for one of the Swedish intelligence agencies, civilian or military. MI6 discussed the tip-off with the Danes, and discreet inquiries were made. "It didn't take long to nail him," said Guscott. "We soon had enough to identify this man with near certainty." Sweden was an important ally, and evidence that the Swedish intelligence community had been penetrated by the Soviets was too important not to share. Guscott now explained to Gordievsky that this information had been passed to Stockholm without revealing its origin, and would soon be acted on. He made no objection. By now he trusted us to protect him as the source. Gordievsky and Guscott shook hands. For 20 months, without detection, they had met at least once a month, exchanging hundreds of secret documents. This was a real friendship, a real affinity, Guscott said many years later. But it was a strange sort of amity, one that had grown up within strict limits. Gordievsky never knew the real name of Nick Venables. The spy and his handler had never shared a restaurant meal. "I would like to have gone for a run with him, but we could not," said Guscott. Their relationship had taken place entirely within the walls of a safe house, always with a tape recorder running. Like all spy relationships, it was compromised and colored by deception and manipulation. Gordievsky was undermining a political regime he reviled, and gaining the dignity he craved. Guscott was running a long-term, deep penetration agent inside the enemy's citadel. But it also meant more than that, to both of them. Theirs was an intense, emotional bond, forged in secrecy, danger, loyalty, and betrayal. With the copy of Shakespeare's sonnets in a Safeway bag, Gordievsky left the safe flat for the last time and headed into the Danish night. From now on, the affair would be run at long distance. In Moscow, Gordievsky would be able to communicate with British intelligence if he wanted to, but MI6 had no means of initiating contact with him. He could try to escape if he needed to, but the British could not initiate the escape plan. He was on his own. British intelligence could only watch and wait. If Gordievsky was prepared to run the race without knowing when it might end, then so was MI6. At the First Chief Directorate headquarters in Moscow Center, Gordievsky presented himself to the head of the Third Department, explained that he was getting a divorce and planned to remarry, and watched his career shrivel up in front of him. The department chief was a short, fat Ukrainian named Viktor Grushko, cheerful, cynical, and wholly obedient to the moralistic culture of the KGB. "This changes everything," said Grushko. Gordievsky, the high flyer, was brought down to earth with a thump, just as Lyubimov had predicted. Instead of becoming department deputy, he was banished to the personnel section, accompanied by a strong whiff of moral disapprobation. "You've had an affair while on assignment," some of his colleagues pointed out, gloating, "very unprofessional." His work was as tedious as it was inconsequential. Frequently he was relegated to night duty officer. Although still a senior officer, he had no definite function. Once again, he was stuck. The divorce was concluded with unemotional Soviet dispatch. The judge addressed Yelena. "Your husband is divorcing you because you don't want to have children, and he does. Is that right?" Yelena snapped back, "Not at all. He fell in love with a pretty girl, nothing else." By now, Yelena had been promoted to the rank of captain. She returned to her old job, eavesdropping on foreign embassies. As she was the injured party in the divorce, her KGB career was unaffected. But she never forgave Gordievsky, and she never remarried. When the senior women officers in the KGB gathered to drink tea together, Yelena would rage about her ex-husband's disloyalty. "He's an insincere shit, a deceiver, a man with a false front. He is capable of any sort of betrayal." Gossip about Gordievsky's infidelity swilled around the lower reaches of the KGB. Most dismissed Yelena's remarks as the bitterness of a divorcee. "What else do you expect from a deserted wife?" remarked a colleague in the Third Department. "Neither I nor anyone else ever thought to report the matter." But perhaps someone did. A month after Gordievsky's return, his father died at the age of 82. Only a small handful of elderly KGB officers attended the cremation. At a wake in the family flat, packed with more than 30 relatives, Gordievsky gave a speech extolling his father's work for the Communist Party and the Soviet Union, an ideology and a political system he was now actively conspiring to undermine. Years later, Gordievsky reflected that his father's death might have been a liberation for his mother. In fact,